Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I see some new people here tonight who probably may be unfamiliar with what we're doing up here. Basically, what this meeting is about, what it was started for, was it was started with the intent of bringing different presenters up here to share on their experience, strength, and hope on the recovery program. As it's outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's kind of what we do. And yes, God forbid, we are a meeting that's educational, hopefully. One of the things they used to say when I was first coming around AA is there are no teachers in AA. It's a funny thing. All there is teachers in AA. Some of the people teach you what to do. Some of the people teach you what not to do. Hopefully, we have some of the former here, and not the latter. But anyway, what we're doing tonight is we're doing step 10, and this particular workshop is about covering some of the mechanics of the steps from the big book so that we're not irresponsible, but then broadening and deepening the concept of that step with the book, The 12 and 12, which really is the proper application of The 12 and 12. I've said this before, one of the big mistakes I made when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous back in 1989 was I was being told that it's a 12-step program. I was being told that I needed to work the steps, but I was not being guided in any way or shown how to do that specifically. It was more kind of inferred that you need to go do that. So what I did was I went to about a billion step meetings. And one of the things that you learn really quick, if after you've actually gotten some experience with a program out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, is step meetings are a great place to go and talk about the step, philosophize about the step, share about the step, read about the step, and think about the step. But you're going to be hard-pressed to find somebody that's actually done the step in one of those meetings. And that's my experience. Hopefully we're not gonna be irresponsible and not say, where the instructions for the steps are. They're in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's some really good information, to basically expand your experience and understanding of the step in the book, The 12 and 12. And we're gonna touch on both of those things. Why do we in the Tuesday Night Burnsville group talk educationally about the steps? Why do we share specifically on the process? That's kind of not something that is fashionable in some of the other groups in the area. One reason is this: I want to read a sentence out of the step book. This is out of Tradition 9 on page 174. It's one of my favorite lines. It says here, unless each AA member follows to the best of his ability our suggested 12 steps to recovery, he almost certainly signs his own death warrant. Important warning statement. So if we're going to sign our own death warrant by not practicing the 12 steps, isn't it important to understand how to practice those steps? So again, you know, we're not claiming infallibility here if we say we do it this way or we do it that way. More than anything, the different people that come up here share their specific experience with the steps. But there are some things that the people who come up here and present on have in common, and that's basically using the book Alcoholics Anonymous as foundational as far as putting together a program of recovery. So anyway, I want to start here with some of the mechanics out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll find step 10 starting on page 84 in the big book, if you didn't know that already. Step 10 is we continue to take personal inventory. We continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. And we vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. Some of the things that we're asked to do in step 10 is we're to continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. We're supposed to watch for these things. And when these things crop up, first thing we do is we ask God at once to remove them. Then we discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. I see step 10 as a reactive step. How do I react as I move through the day? What type of principles can I apply that I've learned in the steps? What kind of principles can I apply as I move through my day? I certainly don't claim to do this step perfectly. I get caught up in worldly clamors, probably like most people. I'm going through a situation now at work that is—it's just incredibly bizarre. We're in the middle of a contract negotiations for my specific piece of business that I run, and it's been going on for about 8 months now. And every single event that happens is more insane than the next. And the only thing I can do is try to be present to the fact that I am an alcoholic. I need to live a spiritual life. I need to follow certain disciplines. I need to act in certain ways, or I'm gonna start suffering from what the step book calls an emotional hangover. And what that is it's when I fail to practice enough of the spiritual principles. What happens is I suffer emotionally from that neglect. So I'm involved in this insane series of events with my piece of business, and every single day something new comes up. I can't even imagine how I would have survived these crazy events without some kind of program of recovery that I can apply to these things. I mean, my boss, there's a lot of people who just look at me and, how are you, some of my colleagues, some of the people that run pieces of business like mine said, I would have been out of there a long time ago. I don't know how you can possibly be putting up with what you're putting up with. And, it's nothing specifically unique about me. I give all credit where it's due, and that's the credit that I give to my adherence to certain principles of behavior that I find in the steps. A couple of other things in here is it says every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. I see step 10, those are basically the mechanics from the big book. Again, I see step 10 as my using all of the principles that I find in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first 9 steps, and then 11 and 12 also are discussed in step 10. Using all of those as they're appropriate, and again, as I move through the day. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous as an unrecovered, just separated from alcohol, individual, I was a mess. I had a severe lack of dealage. You know what I mean? There was not very much that I could deal with. I'll give you, for instance, in my first 6 months or so in AA, here's a picture of my day. I would wake up. I'd have to be at work at 8 o'clock. I'd wake up at 7:45, wearing the clothes I went to bed with the night before. I'd jump in the car. I'd brush my teeth, wipe my eyes, get out, jump in the car, go to work. And it was an absolute nightmare dealing with work. I was an electrician and I had to not burn people's houses down. And I had a crew, that worked with me, and they were all mutton heads. And I just, you know, my boss, I had problems with my boss, and I wanted to kill him on a daily basis, and the customers didn't appreciate me, and, you know, no one ever did anything right, and I would barely get through the day, and then I would jump in the car, and I'd drive home, and I'd immediately jump into bed and pull the covers over my head, and I'd get some sleep. You know, that 8 hour block of time was just about all I can handle. I would sleep until it was time to go to an AA meeting. Then I would wake up and I would go off to the AA meeting, and 99% of my effort in that AA meeting was spent judging what other people were sharing and deciding where they fell on the hypocrite level. I hooked up with a couple of people, sometimes even more dysfunctional than me, who I would go out to the diner with after the meeting, and we would critique the particular meeting, and then I would go home and I would go to sleep. And I mean, that was all I could handle. You know, just getting through an 8 hour day of work and then going and dealing with the AA meeting and going out to the diner afterwards. And that was difficult. You know, today they talk about in these steps, packing what you can into the stream of life. And today, my life is so ridiculously full. Every spare minute, I can find a real useful, rewarding activity to pack into that spare minute. And it has a lot to do with, of course, with the recovery that comes as you continuously apply these spiritual principles where you can in your life. So I'm really, really grateful for these principles. My life has opened up in ways I didn't even know it could open up in as far as these principles are concerned. And I'm going to start now in the 12 and 12 and read a little bit about what it talks about here. It's page 88 in the 12 and 12. As we work the first 9 steps, we prepare ourselves for the adventure of a new life. But when we approach step 10, we commence to put our AA way of living into practical use day by day in fair weather or foul. Then comes the acid test. Can we stay sober, keep an emotional balance, and live the good purpose under all conditions? Again, there's no way I could stay in emotional balance because I was so emotionally unbalanced. You know, most people today that know me in Alcoholics Anonymous did not know me when I first came in. But every once in a while, somebody will come up to me who I haven't seen in a long time, but went to the first 6 months of meetings with me, and they'd look at me like, "My God, what happened to you? You used to be a psychopath. You know, you're all calm now." And it's true. Lived a good purpose in life. Again, I was a bad electrician. I was terrible. I would burn play. Every day I would electrocute myself. Yeah, I mean, and so I would do things. This was an amends I had to take care of. I had a helper, and I couldn't stand this helper. He used to just drive me crazy. And this is like in early sobriety. So this was Mr. Recovery, right? And this guy used to drive me crazy. This one time I went up on top of an extension ladder to the peak of this guy's roof to put in a floodlight. And I had my helper put the switch in downstairs. And as I was going up the ladder, I go, flip the switch off. So he flips the switch down. I get up to the top of this ladder, and I'm reaching up. And all of a sudden, I'm getting a little shocked, right? I come down off the ladder. I go, "What the hell?" And I walk over, and I look at the switch, and it says, "No foe" on it, right? He put the switch in upside down on me, nearly killed me. I almost fell 40 feet to my death. And Now you gotta understand, I'm German, you know. We like oppress nations. We get resentments that we hold on to for 40 years, and you know, your children's children will be a, and so here's what I do. I am upset with this guy. My boss won't get rid of him because he's like friends of the guy's brother or something. So I start to electrocute this guy on a regular basis. I would have him work in a junction box, and I'd go there with my testers and show him that it's off. And then I'd go around the corner and I'd turn it on. Like this. And after about four or five times, this guy decided to find a different career. And, I mean, you know, this is what I'm like. I couldn't deal with people. I had bizarre ways of handling situations, as I just explained. And, you know, as I got sober, as I got less hostile as the years went on, and as I started to practice a program of recovery, I started to become more useful and more effective in life. And almost without me putting in any effort, I started to become exposed to better and better jobs. I got a state job, and then I got a job as a manager over here. And, you know, today I'm a manager, and I run a pretty big piece of business. And I have a lot of responsibility, and I do human resource work and contract negotiation and all this crazy kind of stuff that I was lucky if I could wire an outlet in your house when I was brand new without doing something wrong. So it's the process of recovery. It's the process of putting spiritual principles to work that just kind of led me into being more effective in my life. So I believe that I live to good purpose today. Not only do I have a work life where really what I do is I improve the quality of people's experience while they're at this certain place. That's what I do. But I've got a life that's of good purpose at home. I've got a life that's of good purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got a life that's of good purpose with my family. You know, I make a difference there. A little further down. No one can make much of his life until self-searching becomes a regular habit, until he is able to admit and accept what he finds, and until he patiently and persistently tries to correct what is wrong. That's a lot. That has a lot to do with the recovery principles. Recognizing, admitting, and then participating in the removal of those specific character defects, making amends for where those defects have caused harm. There's not a lot of people out there in the world that have an effective program of change like that. I believe that it can make us uniquely useful. I think that people sometimes apply certain principles certain positive principles to their work place. I guess if you get involved in some religions, there's a continuing adherence to being a virtuous human being. But I've never seen anything like the 12-step program as far as honing you into a more effective, more honest individual. And that helps everywhere. It helps in your work. It helps in your home life. It helps absolutely everywhere. And the inventory process is so beautiful as far as looking at where you fall short. You know, we all fall short, word, thought, and deed, every single day. But there's not a lot of people out there that are actually inventorying where they fall short, admitting it to another person, becoming willing to have those defects removed, humbly asking God to remove those defects of character, then making amends for where those defects of character have caused harm. You know, I work with a lot of people, and some of the people that I work with have really put this to practice in their workplace. You know, they've made some serious amends with colleagues for different things. And they're getting promoted, and, you know, their bosses are saying, wow, I've never seen anybody do things like, you know, do that, you know, and they're getting renewed trust. It's just amazing. They talk about the emotional hangover. Yes, we had hangovers when we drank, but we get emotional hangovers. I'm sure everybody in here can relate to doing something wrong and then all of a sudden feeling bad about it in one way or another. Guilt, remorse, shame, whatever. Resentment, fear, anything. I became very, very sensitive to that when I got sober. I think the longer you stay sober, the less emotional turmoil you're willing to put up with. In the beginning, I was willing to put up with, I didn't know any better. I mean, I just came off the streets drinking a quart of alcohol and doing every kind of drug you can imagine. I was used to just horrific emotional turmoil. But as I got sober, I started to get weaker in that area. You know, today, I can't tell a lie without like going, oh my God, I told a lie. And you know, I used to live on lies. I wouldn't have known how to tell the truth. They would have thought I was lying if I told the truth, you know, because I would have probably started shaking. You know, it's just, I'm not able to put, or if I hurt somebody or if I like stab somebody in a business type of thing and I've harmed somebody I can't deal with it. I would rather today, it's taken a long time, but I would rather take the high road. I used to base all of my decisions on the next 10 minutes. Like today I can think, well, if I say this, it'll get me through this meeting, but what'll happen 2 weeks later when they find out it's not true? I mean, I don't want to go there anymore. I really try to take the high road just basically because of these emotional hangovers. I want to minimize them, as much as I possibly can. And I've found that just by being absolutely upfront, that's in my best interest. My ego doesn't want me to think that. My ego wants me to think, oh my God, what's going to happen? You're going to tell the truth and then they're going to think you're a jerk. I've just found through practice that it's better to be honest about things. That is the emotional hangover, the direct result of yesterday's and sometimes today's excesses of negative emotion, anger, fear, jealousy, and the like. If we would live serenely today and tomorrow, we certainly need to eliminate these hangovers. And that's basically what I'm talking about. It requires admission and correction of errors now. Our inventory enables us to settle with the past. When this is done, we are really able to leave it behind us. When our inventory is carefully taken and we have made peace with ourselves, the conviction follows that tomorrow's challenges can be met as they come. Again, step 10 really is reactive. How do we take care of today's business today? How do we take care of it before we let the sun set on it? They talk in this next paragraph about a number of different types of inventories. Bill is giving us examples of different types of, you know, Bill allowed a certain amount of latitude with the mechanics of the inventory. By the time that the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions was written, there was some different types of approaches that he shared about in the steps. And I believe that foundationally we must start with the book Alcoholics Anonymous. But one of the things that he makes apparent in the 12 and 12 is that there's ways to stretch out. There's ways to broaden some of these principles. There's additional exercises and additional approaches that one can take on top of the recovery program. He talks about the spot check inventory, which is taken at any time of the day, whenever we find ourselves getting tangled up. Let's say you've just gone through something and you don't feel good about it. You're walking away from it and it was not a real pleasant situation. It could be problems with a relationship. It could be a bad business meeting. It could be cutting turkey at Thanksgiving with the family who drive you absolutely crazy. It could be a number of different things, but you walk away from these and you take a spot check inventory. And you just look at, okay, I'm resentful or I'm afraid. You know, why is that? What parts of my instincts or ambitions were threatened? What's the truth about this particular resentment? What's my part in it? How did I set the ball rolling in this particular situation to get things all tangled up? You know, did I contribute, or how did I contribute to this situation? And you're able to more accurately assess what's going on. The closer you get to the truth with this stuff, the more freedom you're going to get. Then they talk about, then there's the one that we take at day's end when we review the happening of the hours just past. I like to think that he's alluding to the step 11, evening review with this. Here we cast up a balance sheet crediting ourselves with things well done and chalking up the debits where due. Then he talks about what I try to do, which is an annual or semi-annual house cleaning. I like to do a full-blown four-step inventory once a year, sometimes every year and a half. Sometimes I've done several in 1 year. It's kind of a living, breathing exercise for me. And I've gotten to the point where I've done enough of them that I know when I need to do them. And I'll do them now before everything hits the fan, before there's 55 crises and I'm ready to, kill somebody. I'll try to get into my inventory process before that happens. Then there are those occasions when alone or in the company of our sponsor or spiritual advisor, we make a careful review of our progress since the last time or since the last inventory. Many AAs go in for annual or semi-annual house cleanings. Many of us also like to experience an occasional retreat from the outside world where we can quiet down for an undisturbed day or so of self-overhaul and meditation. For years, I rebelled at the thought of a retreat because I would hear people coming back talking about the Matt Talbot retreat. You know, and I knew that Matt Talbot was the hair shirt guy, you know, who, you know, when he died, they found that he flagellated himself and all, you know, I'm thinking like, I don't, whatever. He was into all types of austerity, and I'm thinking, you know, Catholic hair shirt guy, I'm going to go to this. I don't think so. You know, I guess that's for the Catholics or whatever. But that was the retreats that really were available back when I first got sober, and people would come back and talk about how the priest had them do all these jumping through all these hoops, and I'm like, no, you know, I'm gonna hold back on that. So when the time came for me to seriously consider a retreat, I had to start one. You know, I didn't want to do a Matt Talbot. So let's do an AA retreat. So myself and a number of people put together some formats, and for years now, this particular home group has two retreats: one at the Wilson House, one at Lake Skinny Atlas. And we go out there, and many, many people do their inventory process, or they bring inventory and they read inventory out there. And you just look around and you watch like these spiritual transformations, these mind-blowing changes that take place with these people. And I'll do these retreats, and I can see the benefit of them. You know, you get away. You can shut off those worldly clamors for a weekend, and you can just concentrate on spiritual growth. And it's a great thing. I've had a lot of good experiences with it. I went to one of Ray's retreats over here a year or so ago, and I just was going to go there and say hi. I didn't sign up for it. I was going to go in there. I was going to say hi. There was a friend of mine that I hadn't seen in a million years that was there, and there was such stuff going on that I couldn't leave. I ended up being there for like 2 days. If you've never done a retreat before, pick a good one. You know, if you're Catholic, you can do the hair shirt one. But pick one and go and enjoy yourself. The emphasis on inventory is heavy only because a great many of us have never really acquired the habit of self-appraisals. You'll find in any spiritual literature, you'll find in any philosophical or spiritual discipline, self-appraisal, accurate self-appraisal. They even talk about humility being inaccurate self-appraisal. It's really necessary. It's one of the reasons why step four talks about inventory, it's designed to start you on a lifetime discipline of accurate self-appraisal. Something that I never had before. I mean, my perspective on things were wrong, yet I thought everyone else's perspective was screwed up, and I had this unique, deep understanding of the world and its functionings. And it may be a dark, complicated understanding, you know, fueled by a high IQ level and a low tolerance for muttonheads, you know. But I had this, and I would want to tell you about this unique perspective that I, and when I first came into AA, I wanted to explain to my sponsor my particular perspective on something, and he didn't really want to hear it. He said, he would tell me, shut up. You know, Chris, or have you ever thought of it this way? One of my favorite stories is my boss, this is in my first 6 months of sobriety, and I've just driven back to from the supply house with supplies for this particular job because my boss wasn't astute enough to understand that we would need them, and I had to go get them. Usually we would have the supplies at the shop before we went on the day's job. He didn't do his job. And so I come walking on the job, and he's there. And he's really mad that I'm not on the job. And he starts yelling at me, what the hell are you doing? You're not on the job. And I just stood there. I've got my peers, my colleagues are watching me get yelled at by the boss. And it's not even my fault. It's his fault. So I talked to my sponsor that night. I go, I'm going to kill this guy. I'm going to sneak in tomorrow morning. And I know how to make bombs because I was a juvenile delinquent. I'm going to put a bomb underneath his truck, and I'm going to blow up his, and he's not going to be, he's going to go bankrupt. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to blow up his truck. And my sponsor goes, Chris, tell you what. Here's what I'd like you to do. When you get there tomorrow morning, I want you to ask him, I want you to say, Anthony, could I please have a few minutes of your time? I have something that I need to discuss with you. And then you are to tell him this. You are to say, Anthony, I don't really appreciate the tone you took with me the other day. It really disturbed me that you yelled at me in front of all the other workers when it really wasn't my fault. And I don't want you to do that with me again. And I want you to tell him that. And I'm like, what? Are you crazy? I liked the blowing up the van idea better. That made more sense to me. But, you know, this was my sponsor, and I figured it was one of those wax on, wax off things. You know, you got to just kind of do what he says, and, you know. So I go there, and I knock on a door, and I say, Anthony, I need to speak with you alone for a minute. And I said that. And I felt really weird saying something mature like that. You know what I mean? And, you know, I struggled through it, and I get done, and I'd really like you to not do that anymore. And he goes, okay. And he never, ever yelled at me again. I'm like, these sponsor things are pretty good. How the hell did he know that? How did he know it would work? I never thought it would have worked. And the thing was that there was like one thing after the other. He was always right with these things. Finally, I got to a point where I just knew that he was omnipotent. The final straw was I was over his house. And he asked me to house sit his house and watch his dog. I'm like 6 months sober. No one wanted me in their house for like the last 10 years, let alone with an animal. You know what I mean? So I'm over at my sponsor's house, and he has to go to a business meeting up in Boston. And I asked him, I go, Phil, if I take the dog outside, do I have to put the dog on a leash? And he goes, no, the dog never, you know, dog will go right outside. He'll come back when you call him. Well, I guess when you're newly sober, there's like a lot of tension coming off you and stuff. And dogs and cats and stuff pick up on that. You know, they have like that hypersensitivity. So the first time I walk, you know, I'm by myself. I walk the dog outside. Phew, gone. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, the dog is gone. And I'm sitting there. I'm like freaking out. Like, what if I kill my sponsor? My sponsor's dog is gone. What if he comes home and I don't have a dog to give him back? You know, this is going to be horrible. And to make matters worse, somebody calls up about an hour later and says, do you have a black lab? Is that? And I go, yeah. And she goes, well, it's dodging traffic in the middle of Basking Ridge. I'm like, oh, my God. So I call him on the emergency number that he gave me. He said, you know, call this. It's an emergency. You can call this. It's my page. So I call him up, and I drag him out of, like, a board of directors meeting in Boston. I say, Phil, your dog ran away. It's dodging traffic in Basking Ridge. Oh, I don't know what to do. And he goes, Chris, calm down. Here's what's going to happen. Someone is going to find the dog. They're going to bring it back to the house and the cage out in the backyard. They're going to put the dog in the cage in the backyard, and everything will be fine. I'm like, no way. It's going to get run over. I'm sorry. He's like, take it easy, Chris. I've got to go back into my meeting now. Hangs up the phone, right? Half an hour later, I look out the back window. The dog's in the cage. I'm like, my sponsor's God. He knows. I had him up on a pedestal about this high. I mean, he was like Phil, you know, until he yelled at a waitress making $1.75 an hour one time, and I ripped him right down off that pedestal. I thought, you know, treat waitresses like that because you're. Hamburger isn't just right. What's the matter with you? Anyway, my sponsees know enough not to put me on a pedestal, right, Dave? Anyway, this was my favorite. When I read this, I swore it was a typo. It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with us. You know, if you're doing a four-step inventory and you're wondering what principle to put down because you... Geez, I don't know about any principles I'm resentful for. Put this one down. This is a good one. Every time you're disturbed, it's you. It's you. It's not them. It's you. It's an inside job. It took me a long time to really, really come to terms with that and believe it. I truly believe it today. Okay, it talks about disturbances. We all go through disturbances, and it says the spot check inventory taken in the midst of disturbances can be a very great help in quieting stormy emotions. Today's spot check finds its cheap application to situations which arise in each day's march. The consideration of long-standing difficulties had better be postponed when possible to times deliberately set aside for that purpose. Like the big, huge things, deal with it in a four-step form with your sponsor. You know, do an actual four-step. But it says the quick inventory is aimed at our daily ups and downs, especially those where people or new events throw us off balance and tempt us to make mistakes. You know, I believe that sobriety and I believe spiritual growth happens in the midst of life. There's a certain type of spiritual practice which leads to solitary disciplines. You know, there were the Desert Fathers. I've studied the Desert Fathers for years. And basically what they did was they packed up their books and they moved off into the desert where nobody could mess with them. And they could do like 19 hours worth of meditation a day. And that's fine, but in New Jersey, sometimes you have to do it a little bit differently. And I believe that these are spiritual principles that we can practice in the middle of our daily lives, in the middle of the turmoil that we have around us. In all these situations, we need self-restraint. That's something I've been able to develop a little bit. Anybody in here used to just reacting and saying the wrong thing or just getting pissed off? How about just hitting somebody? I know some people in here that just hit you, you know, before they think about it. So self-restraint is especially useful for those individuals. Honest analysis of what is involved. A willingness to admit when the fault is ours, and an equal willingness to forgive when the fault is elsewhere. These are all very, very powerful spiritual principles. I saw a lot of it as weakness because, again, my perspective was off. You know, the spiritual awakening has so much to do with a shift in perception, a shift in your perspective, a shift in how you see things. And today I see these things as strength. I see them as qualities that someone with inner strength has. I don't see them at all as weaknesses. We need not be discouraged when we fall into the error of our old ways, for these disciplines are not easy. We shall look for progress, not perfection. And again, I'm at a point today where I like the fact that it's progress, not perfection. I like the fact that it's not easy because it gives me something to work toward. I think life would be very boring if when you got your 90-day chip, you were perfect and there was no more growth available to you. I like the fact that this is a lifetime process and that each year I get more effective in my life, more effective in my relationships, and more effective in my ability to practice some of these principles. We should train ourselves to step back and think, for we can neither think nor act to good purpose until the habit of self-restraint becomes automatic. Here are some promises. Finally, we begin to see that all people, including ourselves, are to some extent emotionally ill and frequently wrong. I remember they asked for a topic at a meeting one time, and that's what I used. Most people are emotionally ill and frequently wrong was my topic. You know? It had to be outside me for me to be comfortable. It had to be your fault. And then when we approach true tolerance and we see what real love for our fellows actually mean, it will become more and more evident as we go forward that it is pointless to become angry. How about that? It's pointless to become angry or to get hurt by people who, like us, are suffering from the pains of growing up. It's pointless to allow people in enough to hurt you. Now, that's a great ideal. I know that most of us, including ourselves, are pretty far from that. I mean, there are still times when people can hurt me. There are still times when I'm going to become angry. But each year I get better with this stuff. And fewer situations or people can get me angry. And fewer people or situations can hurt me. Such a radical change in our outlook will take time, maybe a lot of time. Here's some more things. We can try to stop making unreasonable demands upon those we love. One of the greatest things I ever heard was a talk that a guy named Chuck Chamberlain gave. He was a huge, huge influence in California Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, there was his funeral was bigger than Bill Wilson's. I mean, he influenced countless people that are still influenced by him today. And he talks about his amends to his family being like this. Now, I'm going to get what he said particularly wrong, but this is basically what he did. He went up and he made amends for the part that he saw that was wrong. And then he told them that I am never, ever, ever going to ask you to do anything again except one thing. And that's if I can ever do anything for you, I want you to tell me. Imagine having an attitude and an outlook on life like that with your family. That you are never, ever going to ask them to do anything for you ever again except if there's anything that you can do for them, please do. Please tell you. I mean, what a shift in perception. I don't know about you, but my family sorely disappointed me and my expectations all the time. And a shift that large in perception is beautiful. But can you imagine? Stop making unreasonable demands upon those we love. We can show kindness where we had shown none. With those we dislike, we can begin to practice justice and courtesy, perhaps going out of our way to understand and help them. Whenever we fail any of these people, we can promptly admit it to ourselves always and to them also when the admission would be helpful. Courtesy, kindness, justice, and love are the keynotes by which we may come into harmony with practically anybody. When in doubt, we can always pause saying, not will, but thine be done. That's direct out of the big book. And we can often ask ourselves, am I doing to others as I would have them do to me today? That's from the Golden Rule. When evening comes, perhaps just before going to sleep, many of us can draw up a balance sheet for today. This is a good place to remember that inventory taking is not always done in red ink. Here's where Bill Wilson shifts a little bit in the 11-step evening review, where he starts adding that we can put some positive things in also. He makes it more clear, actually, in the 12 and 12, that you can put some positive things into your inventory sheet at the end of the day also. And I do that. You know, I look to some of my successes also at the end of the day, some of the things that that work out well. I had a huge success. It was short-lived, but I had a huge success about 2 weeks ago in a business deal. I suggested to some of my bosses that we take a certain tact with this contract negotiation, and it was bizarre in that it flew against any real business logic, but I just had kind of a gut feeling with this thing, which is basically this: we were under incredible competition with this contract, and instead of suggesting that we lower our price, I suggested that we double it. And I won't get into the specifics of this, but we ended up doing that. We doubled our price, and when we went to the bid opening, we were the only people there. So it was a huge success, at least momentarily. At the end of the day, you don't think I wasn't thinking about that. I was pretty happy about that. So I'll throw in some positives in the evening review. On the next page, it says, when prideful, angry, jealous, anxious, or fearful, we acted accordingly, and that was that. Here we need only recognize that we did act or think badly, try to visualize how we might have done better, and resolve with God's help to carry these lessons over into tomorrow, making, of course, any amends still neglected. Again, it's about spiritual progress. It's about recognizing some of the areas that we fall short, practicing recovery principles, where we can apply them, and progressing and growing spiritually. I'll tell you right now, here's your problem if you're anything like me. Your problem is alcoholism. That is the issue. In everything that entails, that alcoholism is monstrous. The more you learn about step one, the more monstrous you see alcoholism as a problem. Your solution is spiritual living. That's your solution. So we need to start developing our capacity to grow spiritually. There's a lot of latitude in this stuff. You know, start with the book Alcoholics Anonymous, use the Alcoholics Anonymous principles. But many of us in here have developed disciplines for spiritual growth that go way beyond the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I know some people in here that are very far advanced with some of those disciplines. There are cases where our ancient enemy rationalization has stepped in and justified conduct that was really wrong. Anybody in here relate to that? How about this? If you don't make amends quickly, you figure out how to justify it so that it doesn't really take an amends because of this. I mean, that's how our ego will jump in and twist things around and justify our behavior. I find with myself, the longer I allow myself to not make an amends, the quicker my justification machine will go to work and move me away from the perception that I actually do have to make that amends. So I try to make them automatically as quick as possible, even when it's not very comfortable. Here's one that relates specifically to me. We constructively criticized someone who needed it when our real motive was to win a useless argument. Or the person concerned not being present, we thought we were helping others to understand him, when in actuality our true motive was to feel superior by pulling him down. For many, many years, I started my prayer regime off with this. God, please allow me, please remove from me my incessant need to judge, criticize, and gossip about my fellow man. I'm talking for the past 15 years. That's how I started out my prayer regime in the morning, because I recognize each of us have specific areas where we know they're really, really a trouble spot for us. Mine was criticizing other people. Mine was judging other people. And for years I prayed and nothing ever seemed to happen. And it got to the point where I had to start really looking at, why wasn't this being removed from me? Am I participating in this enough? Am I participating in the removal process enough? And I saw that there, I just have to remove myself from this. I have to participate in this too. God's not going to remove my need to criticize and judge other people just because I'm asking Him to. I need to participate in this also, and I need to participate in it. And what I had to start doing was I had to start making amends where I was really causing some problems. I'll give you an example of one of them. There was this one individual who came into another home group of mine, and he just did things that I really disagreed with as far as calling business meetings and group consciences. And this guy, as far as I was concerned, didn't understand what Alcoholics Anonymous was about and was just causing trouble. And he was starting these business meetings that really just freaked me out. And I criticized the hell out of this guy. I said, you know, so-and-so is calling this business meeting and it's about this and I can't believe it. And I'm in the middle of a four-step inventory, and guess who shows up in the resentment column? This individual. Well, I get through it. I get up to step 9. I've got to go make direct amends to this guy. So basically, you have to be careful with these type of amends, because you don't want to rip open, you don't want to open a wound that isn't even open when you're making an amends. So I basically went to the individual and I said, look, I got to tell you, I've disagreed with I have not been willing to see your side. It's been upsetting me, some of these business meetings and blah, 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 blah. And I just want you to know that I've looked at this and I'm wrong. I'm wrong. You have every right in the world as a group officer to call a business meeting for whatever purpose you want. And I've just been judgmental, and I just want you to know that I had ill feelings and I just don't anymore, because I've looked through this and I see what my part in it is. And I'm really glad I did that, because this individual ended up committing suicide about 3 months later. And I was clean with the guy. You know what I mean? I was clean with the individual. And, you know, there was no unfinished business between us. And we actually got closer after this amends. So a lot of times these amends move us into a different perspective. And I found that a lot of my judgmentalism, a lot of my criticizing people has left me because of some of these practices. Not all of it, I'll be honest with you. We sometimes hurt those we love because they need to be taught a lesson. Anybody ever do that? Family members? When we really want to punish. We were depressed and complained when we felt bad. I won't even go into all this. But again, there was no one with a better insight into the alcoholic personality and mindset than Bill Wilson. He had us pinned down. He was such a beautiful alcoholic himself. He suffered from everything I suffered from and then some. And he was just so great at putting together a philosophical understanding of the alcoholic with a practical method of recovery from those aberrant behaviors and beliefs. So again, you know, step 10 is a reactive step. I believe I use it. I use it like I would use a weapon. You know, pull it out when you need it, kind of thing. And my life has improved in unbelievable ways because of it. And I've talked enough tonight. I'm going to turn it over to my friend Dave.
Dave.
Go for it, Dave.